Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, and here I am, bright and cheerful, wearing railway tracks.
What do you mean, railway tracks? Have you got braces on?
No, I actually went to the Shinkansen shop in the studio in Tokyo Station and bought some Shinkansen chopsticks.
Okay.
And some Shinkansen material.
Right, okay.
I know, I'm a nerd.
You're painting the picture for everyone who can't see you. Today is also World Environment Day. Happy World Environment Day.
Yes, it's interesting because we've finally had America, one of the big players, cutting in and say, well, we're going to do something about this carbon dioxide thing, and other people saying, no, it's not real. So something will happen. You know, the pendulum swings. It takes time. But here's an interesting thing for you. I'm going to ask you two questions without notice. You ready for it?
Yes.
Okay, so once upon a time, slavery was legal, definitely immoral, but illegal. It was still legal. And then they stopped slavery in the United Kingdom. Question number one. Did the slave owners get paid compensation for the lack of their free labour?
I'm going to say probably.
Yes, correct. Did the slaves who suffered get paid compensation?
I'm going to say probably not.
You're so good, Zan.
My cynicism has answered those questions.
Yes.
Yeah. Where does that come from, Dr. Carl? Where does that come from? How does that relate to World Environment Day? I'm trying to pit together the pieces here.
Well, with regard to the people who currently benefit from poisoning our atmosphere with carbon dioxide, where do you think the compensation money will go?
Right.
To the people who make profits, which they'll lose, or to the people who suffer and who will have bigger costs further down the line?
Questions are the way we begin this hour, and we'd love to hear yours. 1-300-055-36 is the number to call. Dr. Carl's with us for the whole hour, and we're going to head to Wollongong first, where Adam's on the line. Hey, Adam.
Hi there.
What's your question,
Adam.
Dr. Carl?
I was wondering, mainly when I'm washing up, I put hot water in, then cold. But if I do the opposite, it seems that the hot water or the water gets colder quicker than if I do it the first way.
Okay, two factors involved. Suppose in an ideal universe, which is just isolated and there's nothing in the universe except for two volumes of water that are the same. One at, say, 20 degrees C, which is tap water temperature, we'll say, and another one, say, at blindingly hot, which is 90 degrees centigrade, which is dangerous. By the way, 55 will blister you. You get into a shower at 50, you're in big... Okay. So suppose there's one at 20, one at 90. They're equal volumes. You'll end up at a number which is halfway in between, which is 20 plus 90 is 110 divided by 2, 55. So the cold will get hotter and the hot will get colder. But then we add a complication. Newton's law of cooling. The rate at which the temperature drops of something... The amount of heat that escapes is proportional to the temperature difference. Now think of a ball on a hill. If the hill is shallow, the ball will just roll down slowly. If the hill is really steep, it'll go down really quickly. So if there's a big temperature difference, then the heat will escape. Heat is energy.
Yeah.
Right? But if there's a small temperature difference, the heat will escape slowly, which is why it makes a difference if you've got to answer the door and you've got a cup of tea and you've got to add the milk to it and you've got to get rid of them after 5 minutes. It makes a difference to when you add the milk. Do you add it now or later, and I'll leave that as a question for later on. So if you're if further interested in this, Dr. Adam, I would get a thermometer and just have fun. And they're fairly cheap, and you can get the modern fancy ones that you plug into your phone, God damn it. You know, smartphones can have a thermometer.
Get a thermometer and have some fun, Adam. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Adam.
Do you remember a few weeks ago, Dr. Carl, we had a caller who said that they could pour water into one ear and it came out the other ear, suggesting that the water was going through their skull and pouring out the other side. We have that caller on the line. Kate is back with us, calling in from Bendigo. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how you going?
Good. Have you been testing your theory?
I have been testing every time I have a bath.
And how'd you go?
And I am now, I have to say, I am one in a trillion, Dr. Carl. I'm special.
Go on. So tell me how you do the experiment.
So you told me to get some, not Play-Doh, but some blue tack and make a little, like a little well on my one side of the ear. And so I put my ear into the bath water. And what I forgot to tell you was that actually I can hear on my other side of my ear, I can hear the water coming, going into my head. And then when I tip it to the right or the left, or for initially to the right, I can feel the water through this little tube and it comes out and then I collected it in the little in my little pocket. So you thought it might be just the hair kind of gushing down, like the water coming off the hair, but I caught it in my little well. So
hang on. So he's saying that the test was to see if there's a hole in your skull from one ear to the other.
Yes.
And what I said was that according to conventional anatomy, there's a whole bunch of structures in the way. An eardrum on each side and then bone and then brain. And you're saying that in your case, there's definitely a hole that goes all the way through from one external ear hole or auditory canal, if you want to be fancy, to the other one. Okay, let's do the experiment better. Now, this is the thing. You can do experiments but not do them well. Basically, because you don't know. Look, doing experiments well is really hard. It takes 4 years of study to become a physicist. So here's the trick. What you should do is go to the chemist and just buy a diabetic syringe.
Yeah.
Right? And then get one of your friends to fill it up, get rid of the needle. Get rid of the needle. Definitely get rid of the needle and very carefully get maybe one of your nurse friends or a medically trained friend or anybody or an AMBO friend to very slowly dribble from the relatively small hole, the plastic hole in the end of the diabetic syringe, dribble maybe half a mil of water into the ear that is pointing up to the sky.
Okay.
And then wait to see how much comes out the other end.
So you're taking out the bath and any excess water. It's just about the water that is in the syringe. Maybe try that, Kate, and let us know. We're loving this journey, though.
Yeah. It is a journey. I am the one in a trillion, Dr. Carr. I'll call you in 4 years.
Maybe.
Everybody's special, Kate.
And remember, experiments are really hard to do, which is why it takes 3 or 4 years to become a real physicist, and I'm not one of them.
Thanks for the call, Kate. Oh,
okay. Thank you.
Check back in with us. Let's head to Bathurst now with Casey. Good morning, Casey.
Hi, how are you going?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is regards to our subconscious self when we're asleep and our physical self as we sleep as well. What happened the other night was I was having a dream and I was talking to somebody, and in my conversation I said to them, excuse me, I need to sneeze. And I had this feeling of going to sneeze and then I woke up and I sneezed. So I just want to know like how our physical self communicates with those messages into our subconscious self to let us know that we need to sneeze or get up and go to the toilet.
Yeah, that would be the same as when you, like, I sometimes when I need to go to the toilet in the middle of the night, I'd have this recurring dream where I'm a Labrador but trying to use a human toilet and it's really hard and that makes me wake up. So isn't it the same kind of, is that oversharing, Carl? I don't know.
Isn't that
the same sort of theory that, you know, our subconscious is communicating with our unconscious?
Yeah, I've said it before and I'll say it again. There are two different people. There's the awake Casey or Zan and the sleeping one, and they just meet at the changeover when you're waking and sleeping and being forced to wake up with a full bladder or the desire to sneeze or fart. Can one fart in one's sleep?
That was another question that we had, but that line's dropped off. No, I raised that with you off air. But that's a different topic. But in terms of so mentally we can do that, Dr. Carl?
Really?
Yeah. No, I'm asking you a question. Can we
don't
do that?
Know.
Okay.
Don't know that. Right. I mean, can we fart in our sleep?
That was another question from someone else. We haven't.
I know. I want to know the answer to it.
Like, yes, we can fart.
I might be oversharing.
How do you know?
Because I've heard people do it next to me.
No. My God, the cads.
We're getting
how
off topic.
Ungentlemanly.
Girl, have we answered Casey's question?
Not really, because consciousness is so hard. So, what was the exact question? Does your consciousness bleed from asleep to awake?
Yeah, like just how do they communicate was pretty much my question. Like I know that obviously from my own experience, sneezing and with Dan's, like, you know, her toilet experience. And I know with my boyfriend, like when he's asleep, I have heard him pass gas in his sleep, but he hasn't actually woke up to do it.
Really?
And I'm assuming that, like, I'm human too, so I'm assuming I've done it. But, like, yeah, I just don't know how that works. But, yeah, I guess you kind of...
Neither do I.
No. Yeah.
We'll leave it for now, Casey. Maybe someone can fill us in. And thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. And we do have some sleep experts in Sydney, world-class sleep experts. Maybe it's worthwhile getting them in one day.
1-300-055-36 is the number. Dr. Carl's with you. The text line is filled with people confirming that, yes, you can fart in your sleep. Going to head to Narrabri where Scott's on the line. Hey, Scott.
How you going?
Great. What's your question?
Do you know anything about min-min light?
Yeah, common around Winton in that that very clay part of the countryside of Queensland, bottom left-hand corner, yeah.
Yeah, no, we were just talking about it at work this morning and, yeah, the boys just wanted me to ring up and find out and see what you knew about them.
The Min Min lights go back in history about a century or so, and the story is that you're travelling at night in that part of the world down the bottom, you know, around Winton, where they've got some very good dinosaur bones, and where a whole bunch of trucks got trapped for about a month in the floods about 30 years ago, and then they all went broke, the poor truck drivers, because they couldn't get out of town. Anyway, so these lights, you see the light on the horizon and you start walking towards it, and no matter what you do, it doesn't get further away, it doesn't get closer. It's always the same distance. And the problem, the mystery of the Min Min lights was solved by a Queenslander, Jack Pettigrew, Pettigrew. And he was the guy who solved it, and he reckoned it was because the countryside there has all sorts of ups and downs and valleys and all sorts of stuff like that. And you get air trapped inside the valleys, and then this will lead, he reckoned, to all sorts of weird atmospheric effects. And so he reckoned that the light was being channeled in a pile of different temperature air, a layer of different temperature air close to the ground, and then he proved it. He worked out where it should be, then went over the horizon about 100 kilometres away or 80 kilometres away, and then shone his car headlights in the direction of his friends and then rang him up on the phone. Can you see the lights? Yes. Then he turned his lights off. On, off, on, off. So they could see him over a distance of 50 kilometres over the horizon. So with that experiment, he proved that it's just lights over the horizon, not the ghosts or vampires or the aliens or the chemtrail people or anybody else.
Yep.
Makes sense, Scott?
Right, and thanks for that.
No worries. Thanks for the
call.
Thank
you, Scott.
Let's head to Dom in Brisbane, who's been doing an experiment. I know you love them, Carl. Hello, Dom.
Hey, how are you going?
Very well. What have you been doing?
So you know when you're driving a car, if you turn your aircon on, it's going to chew up your fuel more.
Yep.
But go on.
Well, I always wondered that because it's using more electricity and that's why it's generating it, is if you you turn up the stereo full bore, I was wondering if that would affect it at all.
And yes and no. What have you done? Have you done an experiment?
Yeah, well, I've just gotten a new car recently, and it's got a fuel economy thing in it.
Ah, so is it a gauge that tells you what vacuum the engine is drawing, or does it tell you how many kilometres per litre you're drawing?
It tells you how many litres per 100K.
Litres per 100K is good, okay.
So I did a couple of drives, like I did a control where there was no stereo and no aircon on, and that came back saying 4.6, and then I did one with the aircon on full bore and no stereo, and that came back 5.4, and then I did one with the stereo turned up full bore and wearing ear protection, of course.
Very good.
And it came up as 4.8 litres.
Ah, so the car, just being a car, was 4.6? Car plus sound was 4.8.
Yep.
And car with aircon only was 5.4. Did you try aircon and sound together?
I did, and it came up as the same as just with aircon.
Wow. And how many runs did you do back and forth on the same road?
I did each test. I did three tests of, and they all came at the same number.
Three is a small sample size, but they come at the same number.
Oh, come on, Carl. I think we're getting towards a prize pack here.
Okay. Does your car have a big engine or a little engine?
I think it's about a 2 litre. I made sure before I started doing any of the tests it was all warm and all that kind of thing.
Okay. I'm surprised. I'm definitely surprised that a reasonable size engine, 2 litres, would have that much of an effect. If it was a very tiny engine giving good fuel economy, then anything would affect it. But I'm surprised.
I think that the amount of effort that Dom has put into making sure it's a controlled experiment, the amount of times he's done it, I think that he needs a Triple J fun pack, Carl. It's been a while since we gave one out.
And he deserves it because he did it more than once.
Exactly. Dom, stay on the line. We're not exactly sure whether it exists or not. I mean, maybe a mechanic might know if this is a true, a fact of whether, using a stereo chews up petrol.
I just figured it would be using more power and, more electricity, and so I'd have to generate more.
Yeah, maybe.
But the numbers don't match up because the engine, if it's a 2 litre car, it should be delivering 100 kilowatts. And, hang on, when you're going at 80 k's, it's probably only using about 20 kilowatts. And the maximum sound that you can be, the aircon, you can easily use a kilowatt. But sound, Half a kilowatt? It'd be huge. I thought you might have had one of these cars that's just got a huge bass speaker in the boot, but it's just a regular board straight off the showroom floor. And I'm surprised that you went from 4.6 to 4.8.
It was pretty loud, even with the ear protection on.
Okay. Mate, I think... leave us your address and we'll send you some more secret fun packs. I need a mailing address for you.
Secret fun packs.
Secret fun packs.
Stay on the line, Dom. We'll get your details for you, okay?
Will do. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dom. Let's head to Narelle calling in from Sale. Hi, Narelle.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
Yeah, I was just wanting to know why peanuts are oily when other nuts are not. Now, I've sort of assumed that maybe it's because they're a ground nut where the others are trees, or whether it's the way they're processed.
They are oily, aren't they?
Mm.
Brazil nuts are pretty oily as well.
Yeah, they're radioactive as well.
Very slightly radioactive.
Okay. Very slightly radioactive. Not radioactive enough to damage you. Ah. I guess that in their natural form they've got relatively little medium protein but just lots of oil in them. I'm trying to look desperately here on Wikipedia to see what it says about the nutritional value. Okay, looking up nutritional value. And it's got carbohydrates. Oh, fats. Wow. Out of each 100 grams, half are fats, 48 grams. Ooh. 7 grams saturated. Monounsaturated, 24. That's a good stuff, like in olive oil. And polyunsaturated, 16.
Yeah, well, because they make peanut into oil as well.
Mm. So I was surprised. I had no idea. So there's 25 in each 100 grams, roughly, half fat, quarter carbohydrate, quarter protein, roughly. Wow.
Would it have anything to do with the fact that peanuts are legumes and not nuts, Dr. Carl?
I know, they're not nuts. It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Mm. Would that have any effect on it?
Might. I don't know. That's from a range of knowledge. Where is our botanist who would just know this stuff off the top of their head?
We'll see if we can find out for you, Narelle. Thanks for the call.
Worries. Thank you.
Let's head to the Gold Coast where Darren's on the line. Hey, Darren.
Hey, how you going?
Great. What's your question?
I just want to know why the ads that you're watching on TV are 10 times louder than the show you're watching.
They are. Dr. Carl, what's the reason?
Because your hearing is logarithmic and they do a trick called compression where instead of having the sound go up and down and up and down and up and down, they're allowed to go to a certain level and everything is that level. So if you're watching an ad, then the mum and dad talking to each other in the front of the boring car are saying, "Hi, honey, love you very much." And then the kid way off in the background who should be quiet, they're at the same level. So everything's compressed and brought up to absolute maximum just so they can annoy the heck out of you. And yeah. I remember way back years ago, before there were such things as remote controls, what we used to do was get into the TV speaker, get a pair of twin-core wire, bring it out to a switch and just switch off the sound. It's really, really annoying. And I think it's a testimony to their power that they're allowed to get away with this while allowing that so-called they're not actually louder law to be in place when everybody knows how they get around it. Naughty, naughty. Well, think about this. The real reason that commercial TV exists is to sell you dog food, and the stuff in between the ads is to keep you watching until the next ad for dog food comes up.
Yeah, so it's a commercial answer, really, Darren. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Great.
Compression.
Help my rage, though.
Yeah, Mute button is your friend.
Yeah, and by the way, the very first remote controls were based on not infrared or radio, but on audio sound. And there were little tiny hammers inside the remote control that would bang on little blocks of aluminium and then create a tone that would go to a microphone in the front of the TV. We've moved on since then.
Rob's calling in from the Central Coast. He is a mechanic. He's answered our call. Hello, Rob.
Hey, Zan, how are you?
Great. What's the reason, or is there a reason behind burning more fuel if you crank your stereo?
There's a bit of a difference in the way that they run. An aircon runs off a belt which runs on the crankshaft, and it has a compressor. And when you engage the AC, the clutch, it engages as well, and it creates like a drag on the crank, which makes it harder for the engine to rotate. Therefore, you're going to use more fuel. Whereas a CD player, it runs straight off electricity from the alternator and the battery. So the alternator's constantly running, like when the AC kicks in, it acts like the alternator. If I make sense?
Yeah. So let me ask you this. So with the aircon, there's a bit of a difference with the speed that you're travelling. So apparently, from what I've been reading, at high speeds, if all the windows are down, you're creating drag. And so at high speeds with a light throttle, apparently, in some cases, you can have a better fuel economy. Have you heard of that?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. But at a lower speed, you're not getting better fuel economy. And with the aircon, with the sound system, I can't see the sound system dragging more than 100 watts. And a 2-litre engine would be, 150 watts? Flat out?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
But if it was just going on a light throttle at 80 k's, I think you could probably get by with 10 or 20 watts. That's all you need to overcome rolling resistance, you know, in the friction in the train, and wind resistance. And so 100 watts on top of 10, 15 watts would be significant, I'm guessing.
Yeah, or even like, I think the stereo would have the same effect as turning your headlights on sort of thing. Like,
You're drawing more electricity. Well, the headlights used to be very bright. They used to be 55 watts each, and so that's 100 watts. Yeah. But I didn't think that a car stereo system would draw 100 watts.
No, I guess it does.
Still not convinced. That guy's still got a prize pack, though. No. Thanks so much for giving us a call, Rob.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your excellent explanation.
And let's head to Currumbum right now, where Justin is on the phone. Hello, Justin.
Hey, Ben. You all right?
Very well. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
My question is actually a question on behalf of a friend of mine called Anne-Marie Polden. And she would like to know why, when you weigh yourself before you go to the toilet for a number two, why you still weigh the same after you've been to the toilet.
I love that you said it's for her and you gave her full name. I don't reckon you would have said that if it wasn't a question about poo.
There's no way I wouldn't have.
All right, Dr. Carl, is this true? Do you really weigh the same afterwards after releasing things? I can hear her laughing in the background too.
Well, I weigh myself before and after number ones and number twos, and there's a definite change in weight. There's also a change in weight between going to bed and waking up, even if you don't go to the toilet during the night. Because here's something surprising for you. And most people get this wrong, right? Ruben Meerman, a surfing scientist, is actually going to write a paper on this in a prestigious journal.
Good.
This journal is so prestigious that when it was first started, the word biochemistry did not exist.
Wow.
And so it's called the Journal of Biological Chemistry.
Fantastic. I'd love to have a read.
You'll have to tell your friend to read that article.
Yeah. So here's the question. When you lose weight, when you lose, say, a kilogram of fat, when you lose weight, how do the atoms get out of your body? And the answer is through your mouth.
Right, okay.
Your mouth is your main excretory organ.
The more she talks, the more weight she'll lose.
No, because you're always losing a bit of carbon dioxide. It mostly comes out as carbon dioxide and water vapor, but that's where you lose most of your weight. In your gut, you've got a semi-permanent mass of, say, between 0 and 1.5, 2 kilograms.
Right.
And if you just simply stop eating, all you're doing is getting rid of that stuff there. You're not chewing into your body fat. But definitely, when I do it on my scales, I lose weight, and I love, in fact, going for a run in the morning. And so before and after doing a run, I only run about 4 kilometres, and I do it in the sprinting thing, and I will come back weighing 400 grams less.
Wow.
And some of that is sweat, and some of it is water vapour and carbon dioxide out through my mouth, because instead of moving 5 litres a minute, I'm moving 50 litres a minute.
Yeah.
Now, these scales that this mysterious Anne-Marie Polden, whose name we won't mention, do the scales work with a little needle that just goes up, or are they the more modern digital-type scales?
I believe they're the old analog scales with the needle.
You got to get some digital scales. Yeah. I mean, your friend's got to get some digital scales.
Your mysterious friend, whatever her name is, Anne-Marie.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for the call, Justin and Anne-Marie.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carl. Thank you.
Loving that screeching in the background. I can just hear her there. Why didn't she ask the question, Dr.
Carl? She's shy.
Hey, you know what? Everyone has to poo. There's a breaking news. Everyone poos, so remember that, and it's an amazing leveller for all people in the world. Let's go to Amelia in Adelaide. Hello, Amelia.
Hello, how are you?
Who also poos. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
I would like to know, how does anti-venom work and why is there no equivalent for synthetic chemicals?
Carl.
I remember being shocked when I was getting a lecture from a surgeon and he said if somebody has swallowed, for example, Drano accidentally or a dishwasher liquid, you know, the not the detergent but the one you put in a dishwashing machine, don't try to get it out.
All right. You're supposed to ingest caused, it and just go through it, let it go through.
It's already caused damage once on the way down and the esophagus is the most fragile part and it's going to cause damage on the way out.
Mm.
Just let it get diluted and let it stay in a part which has got better healing capability. So the point is that the most of the chemicals that are the poisons in the environment, for example, the carbon monoxide, etc., they're pretty simple chemicals. The sodium hydroxide, the bleach, etc., they're pretty simple chemicals and they just work in a blunderbuss approach. Whereas if you get the toxin, the venom of a spider or a snake. It's a very complicated molecule and it's got a whole bunch of different jobs. Some of it is to split its way between the tissue layers and others is to, whenever it comes in contact with blood vessels, to burst them open. And you can get chemicals which are uniquely designed to find that complicated chemical and then marry onto it. And I think, but I'm not sure, that the action by which they do it is, begins with the letter C. I've forgotten it, it just went out of my brain. But basically they make a chelate, C-H-E-L-A-T-E. Imagine you've got a hollow cage and the molecule, the bad molecule, just goes into that cage and it's inactivated. So with a sophisticated chemical, you go to a lot of trouble to make up something that'll mop up that chemical alone. But something like sodium hydroxide is just like a hammer.
Hey, thanks for the call, Amelia.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A lot of people texting in as well about bowel movements, which is, you know, joyful for me to read. But this one, I lose 200 to 500 grams per bowel movement. My best so far is 720. That is a lot of waste.
720? Well, it
seems like maybe
bacteria.
You're eating too much if that's coming out. That's a lot of stuff.
Well, good point.
Hey, I get to see this text line. If only you could see the things that we don't say on air. Let's go to Brisbane where Nick is on the phone. Good morning, Nick.
G'day, how you going?
Very well. What's your question?
Quick question. 22 divided by 7 or the pi function on a calculator, which is more accurate?
Oh, the pi function. So pi is a close approximation to 22 on 7, but pi is actually goes on more. It's 3.14159265 and on to infinity. So 22 on 7 is just a first approximation, is not exact. And I remember in primary school when I started doing this sort of stuff, in high school, I remember thinking, but why isn't it exactly pi? And it took me about a year to get into my head the concept of a first approximation, something that was good enough but not quite. It wasn't quite accurate, but it was good enough.
So there has to be a finite number of times that the diameter is able to fit, the chord of the diameter is able to fit into the circumference. So
no. It's an irrational number of times it'll fit.
Oh.
It's not a rational number. It just goes on and on and on and on and on forever. So there's infinity in a circle. Isn't it amazing?
That is amazing.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Nick. Thanks for waiting, Grant. What's your question?
Hey, good morning, Dr. Carl, Dr. Labrador.
Labrador?
Why do I tell these stories about my life on the radio?
Sucks you in.
All right, go
Dr. Grant,
on, Dr.
Lay it
Grant.
On us.
Doctors. I've got a really weird thing that happened at work the other day. I was looking, I had some polarizing sunglasses on and the sort of fishbowl safety goggles over the top of that. Looking at a vehicle that was in, had the sun shining on it and looking at the windscreen, and the windscreen was going all these iridescent sort of blues and purples and greens and sort of different colours. If I took off the goggles, the big fishbowl goggles over the top, the effect went away. If I took the sunnies off but put the goggles back on, the effect wasn't there. But if I had both of them on at the same time, all of these really amazing colours coming off this windscreen. And eventually I realised, as I moved my head around, the colours changed. I realised after I'd wiped the front of the goggles, there must have been some sort of grime or oil on it, and the effect went away then as well. And it didn't come back, obviously, because the oil had gone. But it was a really... It had to have both the polarising sunglasses and that thin film of oil. And I know that when the sunlight reflects off the windscreen, that's producing polarised light. So I'm guessing there's some interaction between the two and this thin film, but what is it?
Ah, in one word, interference. Go and look it up on our good friend Wikipedia, and you can see interference, the type of interference, if you're standing on a headland and you see the waves coming towards you in a long line, this straight wave coming towards you, and then not a breaking wave, just a wave in the ocean, just unbroken, and then it comes around the corner. It changes direction. Now, that's one thing that can happen to a wave. That's called diffraction, the bending. Yeah. And then if you get more, the next level up is called interference, and the best I can say is that the waves are interfering with each other and giving colours, and for that, you need to have pictures, and the pictures exist on Wikipedia. But that's the phenomenon.
Is there a name for that specific effect, though, with the colours? Because I think it's related to the way you get colours on, like, a liquid crystal colour display, like on your smartphones and stuff like that, whereas the old-school liquid crystals were just black and white on a calculator, you know?
I think it's interference, but I'm not entirely sure. I'll have to check up myself. That's a good question. You got me on that one, Grant. Sorry.
Thanks for the call, Grant.
Thank you. And we got an answer here about the cars. And somebody is saying that at one level, if the car power, the engine power is 100 kilowatts and the radio power is 100 watts, they're saying the radio is insignificant by a factor of 1,000. Mm. And then we go the other end and people are saying they've measured the basic car stereo head plus four speakers easily draw 100 watts, can go up to several hundred watts. So if you've got more than a couple of hundred watts from your radio and you're just idling in your car, just barely overcoming rolling resistance, you're not drawing 150 watts, you might be drawing 8 or 10. Suddenly it can make a difference.
Thank you for the group think and helping us out with these questions this morning, Australia. Let's head to Newcastle now where Matthew's on the phone with a question. Hey, Matthew.
Yeah, hi, guys.
What's your question for Dr. Carl?
My question is, I guess, relating back to the Carl's comment before about tolerating temperatures and blistering at 55 degrees, why is it that different people can tolerate different temperatures? Like if I pick up something hot or put my hand in a hot liquid, it doesn't affect me as much as it might someone else. They can't pick up or hold the same sort of temperature that I can.
Well, firstly, I think there's a massive gender difference. And so in a sample size of 100 showering with human females, only two liked colder water. 98 preferred much hotter water than I could bear.
Okay.
So there's a gender difference. And then you have your own personal preset, which is related to a combination of what your genetics are, what your training has been, and what you're currently carrying as body fat. So on one occasion, they got a bunch of people who are going to stay in the Arctic in tents for 3 months to do an experiment. Half of them preconditioned their bodies by going into 10-degree water for half an hour a day for a week before they went into the Arctic, and half did not. The ones who had been, and 10 degrees is messy after a few minutes. So for half an hour, it was really horrible. So just by half an hour a day at 10 degrees in the water for a week, and then they stayed in the Arctic for 3 months, even at the end of that time, they were having fewer chemicals of stress appearing in their urine, which they put into a bottle and then freeze and then label and bring back. So there's all of these other factors on top of your, you know, major genetic difference with regard to temperature.
Yeah, okay, because like, I can put my hand in, say an oven, then tell you what temperature it is, give or take 10 or 20 degrees, and a friend can do the same thing, and he puts his hand in, and he gets sort of half the distance, and he pulls his hand out and yelps in pain, or I can get a tea bag, and I can squeeze a tea bag in my hand straight out of a cup of tea, and it doesn't burn me, but if he did the same thing, he would go quite red and feel the pain a lot earlier, even localised sort of, I guess, less fatty areas, but yeah, that makes sense.
Ah, but there are other factors as well. For example, if you are a tradie, you have calluses on the work areas, on the fingers, and they will insulate the flesh underneath from the higher temperatures.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for the call, Matthew.
Thanks.
I think we've got time for one more really quick one. Brendan's calling in from Frio. Hey, Brendan.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well. What's your question?
Just a question for Dr. Carl regarding cycling. When I seem to ride, like with the wind, I go faster. Against the wind, go slower. But when I also have a side wind, it seems to go faster as well. Just wondering what's going on there.
Dr. Carl.
A side wind?
Yeah.
What if it, you mean dead side, 90 degrees side, or a little bit, mostly side, but a little bit from the front or the back?
No, mostly a westerly, so ride north-south direction. And yeah, when there's a westerly coming.
Oh, this is the Frio doctor.
Correct.
Right.
Does it make a difference in terms of riding through turbulent air?
Wow. Well, it's not so much the turbulence. There must be some sort of weird effect. Now, the first order effect is, of course, the Bernoulli effect, but that doesn't really explain it. I think you'd have to go to the Kutta-Junkowska effect, which I've completely forgotten the mechanics of how it worked. But that is better at explaining how aeroplanes fly than does the Bernoulli effect. There's something going on, and let me get this straight. If the wind is dead on from the side, you can go a little bit faster.
Yeah, my overall speed, average speed, seems to be faster for those rides, yeah.
How much faster?
Only probably half difference, average.
There's a few people on the text line saying, ask if he has disc wheels. Do you have disc wheels, Brendan?
No, well, semi-disc, not deep dish.
Other people are suggesting that you're acting like a sail, which I quite like.
Yeah, the bike is quite aero. The bars are quite the frame is quite deep in the frame size. Potentially, that could be it.
Any reason? Any physical reason or physics reason for this, Dr. Carr?
Well, this goes back to something I learned in first year physics. It's a rhyming law of the universe. There is no force, however great, that can pull a horizontal string perfectly straight. See, we're rhyming straight and great. So what it says is that if you've got a string running parallel to the ground, no matter how hard you pull on it, there'll still be a tiny, tiny sag in the middle at the very least because the force is at right angles. So you forces working at right angles to your direction of motion should have zero effect. But there obviously is something going on. Have you tried it in the other direction to see if you slow down and like immediately turn around and go back in the other direction?
Yeah, there's so many minor differences that make it, like hills and everything, so it's hard to gather. It's just, it's a difficult one to measure.
Brendan, we're probably going to have to leave it there because news is just around the corner. Sorry we couldn't help you out more, but, yeah, you are sailing, so good on you. Thanks for the call.
Thanks a lot. See you, guys.
And Dr. Carl will be back with us next week to talk science. We'll see you then, Carl.
PG Keen.